You're listening to the HFEA in conversation with Darren Criss.
This is Ruben Palas of the Hallett Foreign Press Association, or HFPA, for our podcast series HFPA in Conversation. Today it's a pleasure to have the multi-talented Darren Criss with us. Darren earned critical acclaim for his portrayal of Andrew Cunanan in Ryan Murphy's The Assassination of Gianni Versace, American Crime Story. It's Darren's breakout role. Ryan Murphy was also behind the casting of Darren as Blaine Anderson in Glee, which first introduced Darren to a bigger audience. Darren has also conquered Broadway by starring in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying and Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Darren also records, writes songs, and performs live in shows. His latest album is called Homework. Darren, let's start with your much-praised performance in The Assassination of Gianni Versace. How actively did you seek the role? And did Ryan Murphy have you in mind when he was planning the second installment of American Crime Story?
I think Ryan always had me in mind, which I'm very fortunate to say. I think he said that he's always wanted to do this story in some way or another. He brought this up to me before the first series even came out, the People vs. O.J. Simpson. He brought this up to me. He was shooting the pilot for Scream Queens in New Orleans. It was about maybe four some odd years ago. And he was about to go into pre-production for O.J. And I think they had just maybe cast Cuba. I mean, it was still very much in the fetal stages of production. And he mentioned this to me and how he wanted to do it. I obviously was very excited by it because it seemed, you know, it's an endlessly interesting and compelling story, not to mention an endlessly compelling character that, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, whether it's me being half Filipino or looking like the guy or being in the same age range, it seemed almost too serendipitous of an opportunity for me not to be extremely excited about it. So he brought it up, and he was the one that said he wanted to do it, and he wouldn't do it without me, which I appreciated. And I had to wait three something years until he did it. So I waited for a while. The man keeps pretty busy, but there was a while there where I didn't think he was going to do it, because at one point Katrina was going to be the second season. Things got moved around, and just by a series of events, it became the second season, and there we were. But I was always very, very tantalized by this this opportunity and by this story. And I can't believe, you know, however many years later, here we are talking about it. And I'm very proud of what we did.
You mentioned compelling. Andrew Cunanan was a complex, mysterious, and intriguing person. How did you prepare to play him? And was it hard to shake him off even during your breaks from filming?
Everybody asks me that because I think there's so many wonderful actors who I love and artists that really live deeply in their roles, and then they have trouble getting in and out of it. And my joke is that it either makes me a good actor or a bad one. I don't know the answer. The jury's definitely out on that one. But for me, it lives and dies between action and cut. I think there's a couple reasons for that. It might be my own self-preservation and defense mechanism from having to live in any particularly dark place. He also turned on a dime, so I sort of likewise followed that behavior, I guess, where you could disassociate and compartmentalize feelings and behaviors, because that's just how he was. So for me, I could kind of weave in and out of that. I also think the best parts of Andrew saved me from the worst parts of him, in the sense that, you know, we're not just looking at a horrible human being. We really see and explore and almost celebrate the really more redeeming qualities of him. And not saying that forgives or exonerates the horrible things he did, but it certainly makes you balance out some of the more difficult things and makes us question our own senses of compassion. You know, it becomes a real conflict, which is where the drama lies, and that's what's enjoyable as an actor. But it was nice that I could sort of step out of it. also I was in a comfortable environment. I was with people that I'd worked with for years, on Glee or otherwise. And, you know, it made for a very comfortable, loose atmosphere, which was, it was necessary, because otherwise you'd just be living in this dreary space for a while. So we kept it light on set. And so that made it easier to bring darkness when we needed to, but step out of it just as quickly. As far as preparation is concerned, you know, you follow my guiding light at the end of every project is the script. And although these are real life events, I'm not doing an imitation of Andrew. I don't know Andrew. I've never met him. I've never seen any video footage of him. You can only go off of what you've heard from other people. And even then, is it more important to tell, to sort of copycat what this person, what his characteristics were like, or is it more important to bring to life an emotional content? And that to me was more important. But, you know, we know the facts. Our show is based off Maureen Orth's book, which is an extended version of her Vanity Fair article that she did when she was following the case. So, you know, we have a bunch of A, B, and C's as far as factual things that happen, and then we have to kind of connect the emotional dots in between. And that research is less about knowing Andrew and more knowing the darkest parts of ourselves and sort of trying to relate that to someone like Andrew.
You mentioned half Filipino. One of the most important reasons why Ryan Murphy cast you was that you are half Filipino, like Andrew Cunanan. So he didn't want to whitewash the role. What were your thoughts on Cunanan, especially in regards to the irony that here you were, a Filipino-American actor in your most important and breakout role, and yet you were playing a Filipino-American who was on America's 10 most wanted list?
It's a very strange irony. It's not beyond me how twisted it is that this very exciting moment in my career, having this very conversation, being in this room with the Hollywood Foreign Press and being among these, you know, people who are interested in a certain echelon of pop culture, it is not beyond me that this is directly linked to something horrible that really happened. And if it wasn't for a lot of this destruction, would I be having this conversation? And the answer is no. And so while I'd like to think that if I was in any position to prevent any of these things from happening, if I was there, if any of us had any opportunity to stop any of these murders, we would have done something. I'd like to think I would have tried to intervene in some way, but unfortunately I can't. And the only thing I can do 20 years later, being very helpless, is to try and not exploit this story, not to sensationalize or make a spectacle out of these tragedies, but to tell a story to sort of raise questions and to get us to think about perspectives we may have missed. That's the only power I really have. I often think about the people who are still around that, I mean, not often, it was every day, that was the heaviest weight on my shoulders, was thinking about not only the Versace family, but the lives of the sons and daughters and family members and loved ones of the people that we talk about in our show, that I think before the show didn't really have a whole lot of spotlight in pop culture or society at large in general. I think about the way something like this would affect them, you know, a hot topic, water cooler television show, and what that must be like for them wherever they are to have to deal with this after having trying to cope with it after 20 years. And like I said, the only thing that I can hope I'm doing is trying to create some kind of light from so much darkness and positivity. So yeah, the irony is not beyond me that, you know, here I am almost custom built, you know, just by sheer providence for this role. So how do we bring justice to something that is so devoid of justice? And the only answer to that is trying to bring a conversation that can, you know, help us understand how these things can happen and how we can avoid it and how we can, you know, process a tragedy in terms of how do we get there? And again, how we can avoid it in the future. But it is a strange, cruel irony, isn't it?
Yes.
But again, as it's the first time I've ever played anybody that was close to my. It's the first time anyone's ever really asked about my ethnicity. It's never really come into play, except for folks like yourselves, because we have some Filipino friends and connections, obviously through the Hollywood Foreign Press. So mm-hmm. that's something we celebrate and we like to talk about. Yeah. But I think other than the Filipino community, it's something that hasn't really come up a lot. And in that regard, it is exciting to be able to celebrate that and talk about that, because it's just never something that has come up before. And so if that sheds any positivity towards people who maybe feel more represented, especially when you talk about people like John Briones, who's from the Philippines, that has a wonderful role and does an excellent job. And this is a show that is showing probably the first time in my memory, a really complex Filipino character who is a real person and peers into a real Filipino family's life. To be able to shed light on that is very exciting. I'm very proud to be part of that.
So let's go to some lightness then. Let's flash back to your childhood. What were you like as a kid growing up in San Francisco and for a few years in Honolulu? Were you already into singing and performing? Were you the boy who loves to perform for his family and friends?
No, I hated performing for my family and friends. I really did. It's funny, no one's ever asked me that. But I had my aunties, my Filipino aunts, would always make me perform, and I hated it. I just couldn't stand it. Mainly, I think it was less about performing and more about being told what to do. I think if it was on my own fruition to like do a song and dance number, then I'd be happy to. Because I guess I always wanted to because I enjoyed it. But if you told me to do something, I was like, no way. You know, I remember even as a kid growing up, like if I was going to go home, man, I just really need to like take a shower and clean my room. If I got to the door, my mom said, take a shower, clean your room. I'd be like, well, there goes that. I'm not doing that anymore. I can't do what you asked me to do. Which I'm sure is tied to some more stubborn psychological background that I have about my own decisions in life. But I think I was never, some people need to perform, and for whatever reasons that might need to happen, there's no right or wrong reason to that. I never had this need to, and I think maybe I have a luxury of saying that because I've been very lucky with given opportunities to do that, so I've never felt the sort of pang of what it is not to perform. I think I have a need to connect people. I have an insatiable desire to bring people together, and to have people share a common ground. And that has manifested itself in so many different ways in my life, whether it's just being a general sort of Pied Piper of the party, that I like bringing people that I like together, or more recently, we'll talk about it later, opening a bar with my fiance, whether it's, just having a sing-along in general with the guitar. It's less about me having attention, because I've never been someone that needs attention on me. It's more about having a group. If I'm going to be really sort of holistic and new agey about it, is I like offering group community and catharsis and making people feel good about themselves and about life. And if I can be some kind of a significant contributing factor to that, then I'm all about it. So as a kid, though, if you told me to do it, I wouldn't do it.
But did your musical inclinations come from both sides of your family? Because you mentioned your mom, and she's from Cebu, Philippines.
Yeah.
Where there's a tradition of very good singers, and they like to play the musical instruments.
It's fun. I was watching something the other day that the number one export of the Philippines is people. And a lot of that is in all kinds of, jobs around the world, particularly in Southeast Asia. It doesn't, regardless... a huge percentage of that labor is actually musicians. It's, guys and girls who are great singers and whether they're in the recording industry or in bands, and they're playing all over the place. But it was a really kind of staggeringly awesome percentage of people who are literally exported from the Philippines to provide music. And I thought that was so cool. My mom has always been a bit of a performer herself. She's a very charismatic, fun lady that is a natural performer in her own right. I think maybe in another life, maybe she would have been in performing, but she has sort of a lot of stage fright, so I guess that might have stopped her. But yeah, she's very musical and loves music and raised us with music everywhere. My dad is a bit more of the sneak attack musician. I think I have this whole theory about people who have musical ability that don't play music. I think there's a huge percentage of people on the planet who have a sort of genetic inclination for music, unbeknownst to them. And I think my dad has one of those things, you know, singing in church, you know, he'd always sing on key. If it was too high, he would go an octave lower, which takes a little bit of, you know, inbuilt ability. And he always sings, my dad always jokes, he knows the first five words to every song. We grew up in a household where a lot of singing and music was around. So I think I'm definitely the combination of both my parents, my mom's sort of drive and my dad's enjoyment.
At 10 years old, you made your professional stage debut as Cesario in Fanny.
Yeah,
What do you remember vividly about that, and maybe especially the opening night?
That's a great question. I love talking about this stuff. Nobody asks me about this stuff. That was my first... it's funny now because I don't consider myself a child actor in the sense that you meet a lot of people who were really vigorously working as a young person. For me, it was almost like an advanced after-school program. Yes, it happened to be semi-professional theater, but I still was just a kid. You know, I was still going to school, and I wasn't like going on auditions and commercial stuff. I just went to school, and then after school, I did shows. So it still felt very normalized, in my mind at least. But when you put it like that, yeah, I did make my debut. It was a really cool way to grow up. And now that I have enough distance from it, I can really recognize how special of a time it was, because this is the, you know, this is like the mid to late 90s in San Francisco. And there I was being raised by, you know, 20 and 30 somethings after school, when most of my peers, you know, my peers are like 10 or 9. And there I was hanging out with these like older folks that really raised, I think there's a level of maturity that came to me a lot faster, just because I had sort of a really accelerated metropolitan experience, where after school I'd hang out with adults and get food at like 11 o'clock and then they would take me home. So I'm a younger brother, so I've always had this, and I think this bleeds a lot into my career. I always have this, I was talking about this insatiable desire to make people feel comfortable and happy. I think that's tied to this desire to always want to earn my stripes. I like having something to prove to people, and like leaving a good impression, which is why, again, this project was so particularly exciting, because it's another chance to prove myself and to make even more deep to connect to things before. I think Andrew had a lot of that too. Our tactics were different, but, you know, we both want to make an impression and, you know, are attracted to people with big ideas, bigger than ourselves, and we want to be in with those people. Again, our reasons for it, our tactics are different, but, you know, that's how people like me can relate to people like Andrew. But back to that show. Yeah, I remember auditioning for it, and you asked me one memory that I have, and I remember at the audition, the pianist saying, "Monkey see, monkey do." As in, I'll sing a line, you sing it back to me. And I remember thinking, yeah, this is easy. This is really easy. You just sing a line and I can sing it back. And realizing later in life that not everybody can do that. And since then, you know, from the musicals that I've written and worked with people, I use that same tactic when I'm trying to teach singers how to sing stuff. I'll say, monkey see, monkey do, and I'll play something. And if they can't sing it back to me, I'll be like, all right, next.
And in high school, you were voted most likely to win a Grammy. Was music very much a part of your life as a student in high school and then college?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a different... For these kinds of interviews, you're forced to think about things for the first time in a long time. And on the one hand, you want to be, you know, there's a humility here where I'm like, well, I don't want to say what happened because I just sound like a total blowhard. But I would be remiss not to mention... So because I did a lot of theater and I did a lot of music... I was actually, and this is me really just, this is, I guess, a humble brag, guys, forgive me, but it's a fun, it's a fun factoid. They gave me the choice. I got to choose, which one I wanted in the yearbook. If I wanted to be, there was the Oscar one and the Grammy one, which basically is just a polite way of saying, you did music or you did theater, like most likely to win a Heisman. It's like, you were the jock. So it's less about the superlative and more about the way to go. This is what people knew you for. And because I did both, so I got to choose. And the only reason why I chose the Grammy one was because I thought it would be a funner picture with my friend Michelle, because we both played a ton of instruments. So I brought all my instruments and we took like a fun yearbook photo. But it was either that or just stand in front of the theater. I was like, nah, let's go for the cool picture. But yeah, it was really musical. I did a lot of, I it was a Jesuit high school, it was a Catholic school. So I think a lot of the musicians are an outlet for us as, and I think this sounds strange to people that didn't grow up in the church or in any kind of sort of traditional theological background. But you'll meet a lot of musicians that grew up playing in church. And I think what people don't understand is that that's a weekly outlet. And it's less about the actual dogma of the church and more about like, cool, I get to play music. And it was a real training ground for me to play every week. We had mass on Friday or on Sunday, and I would play guitar or piano or drums or bass or sing at every single one. And that was a really great way to sort of just understand playing songs and like reading chords. And that really like made me a way better musician. So because I did that and I would play in bands at the school dances and stuff, music was definitely always a part. We even had an a cappella club that my friend Michelle started that didn't really get off its feet the way I wanted to, but that was the closest thing to what I guess people now call a glee club now. But I was always in music.
And then after college, you and some of your classmates and friends form a musical theater company named Starkid Productions. Mm-hmm. And you got to play Harry Potter in 3 musical comedies based on the Harry Potter books and film adaptations. How much fun did you have doing that?
I tell a lot of people I owe my career to Harry Potter. It's crazy. I mean, I owe it to a lot of different things, but I get great joy, dare I say glee, because it's a good word for it, and it was a word before it was a show, so I feel like I get to say that. It gives me great delight when I meet fans of the Harry Potter shows, because they are really the ones that have been with me and supported me since what I believe to be sort of the beginning of everything. And they're very protective of that. They always say, oh, we liked you before Glee. And not like there's any sort of ranking system. Look, if you have supported me in any way, whether it be yesterday or 10 years ago, or it doesn't matter. I should be so lucky, but I have a soft spot for them because they are part of this really vibrant and avid subcultural fan world that I think a lot of folks would really kill for, and I feel very lucky that they've been in my life. We did those shows for fun, as many college kids that do theater do, and nobody was ever meant to see any of that stuff. It was built directly for us, like we just to make us laugh, for us to have a good time, because we always did those shows. There was like a Lord of the Rings show and a Hobbit musical that we scored with Celine Dion songs. And it's completely irreverent and just fun for us. And the only reason why it ended up out in the world is because we happened to have filmed the Harry Potter one. And after we graduated, instead of going to Walgreens, buying DVDs, uploading it and printing them, then sending them out to everybody, there was this new website called YouTube that we realized, oh, if we just cut it up into a few different parts, we can send a link to our friends and just say, hey, you know, hope the real world's treating you okay, miss you. And that was a way to kind of celebrate what we did our senior year, forgetting that the internet is 100% public and that people actually watched it. And it was terrifying because if we knew, you know, so-and-so from Australia was going to watch it, we would have color corrected it, had better sound. Oh my God, we would have edited it a little better. But ironically, I think that's what people gravitated towards. There was a scrappiness to it that I think people really identified with. And so in that regard, yeah, I had a blast because it was just me with my friends having fun for the sake of having fun. And the fact that total strangers around the world, I just got back from Australia and there was an overwhelming support of that show and Starkid that came from a country that is the farthest I've ever been from home. And that's an incredible thing that we live in a world where this fun little party I threw in college, complete strangers got to go to that party, you know? And the fact that they've identified with that is one of the great thrills of my life.
How surprised were you at how much viewers loved your Blaine Anderson in Unglee? And what did that feel like to get such love? And I think it was your first time to get such good reaction from a mass audience.
Well, so many things about roles are out of an actor's hands. Unless you're an auteur and you're creating the role, then getting a part is lucky. That's the first part. The second part that is extremely just completely where luck takes over and or you just have to hope is in your favor is how an audience feels or where it's set, not only in the story, but where that story is set in a modern day audience. So I have a great deal of, you know, I'm greatly indebted to being attached to a character that people really loved. I mean, Chris Colfer's character was, you know, a universally adored and a wonderful moment and a character for network television, for a lot of young people, for people all around the world. And who knows if I would be here if the character that I had, you know, was a different character or had a different functionality in the story. I think people were rooting for him and for Kurt's character, that for me to be attached to any part of those coattails was a real lottery ticket that I'm very much aware of. And so I'm really grateful that I got to be a part of that. So am I surprised that people liked it? No, because nothing to do with me. I think people were ready for their favorite character to have some kind of love interest. So I really lucked out. You mentioned earlier today when you said, you know, Breakout, you're talking about the Versace role. And what's a thrill to me is that people use that word for me when we were showing up in the media for the Harry Potter stuff. And that was exciting for me as a writer and as a musician. I was like, wow, I guess I'm like a breakout songwriter now. Like, this is cool. Or like a breakout role in the sense that people hadn't heard of me. So that, or even on a much smaller level, that was exciting. Then Glee happens and then that word happens. And then Versace happens and that word happens. And what's exciting to me is that ideally everything is a breakout. You're always breaking out of something that you did before. That's always the point. Everything should always be a departure. So hopefully I can keep that up every few years. But that's an exciting concept that just sort of occurred to me. But I had a blast on that show. Again, I was very lucky because I was joining something that was already a huge hit. So I had sort of a bird's eye view relationship with it my entire time there, because I watched those kids become superstars from my couch. And then to suddenly be sucked into the TV and be a part of their, you know, their party was pretty extraordinary.
And speaking of Glee, a recent big news about you is that you and Lea Michele are hitting on the road in what is called the LMDC Tour. Obviously, both your initials. How did this come about?
Is that what our initials are? No, I'm kidding. Lea and I have always been close, and we've always enjoyed playing music together. We've done a lot of one-off performances, whether they be for, you know, philanthropic events or you know, things like that. And I had her perform at a music festival I started about almost 4 years ago now, called LC Fest, which is the which you got to come to, by the way. You got it. It's a lot of fun. Which is a outdoor sort of cabaret music festival that we do in New York City. And we have a lot of crossover artists from Broadway and film and TV and pop culture come up and do their repertoire or kind of whatever they want. And so Lea is sort of a perfect fit for that. So she came and performed with us last year, and we were, you know, we did some duets and, you know, was working on her set and working on my set. And we always talked about, this is so much fun. This is so easy. This would be a really great thing to take to a lot of not only Glee fans, but Broadway fans that maybe haven't had a chance to see any, I guess, Glee performances since our tour in 2011. And I enjoy going out on the road. Like, you know, this is tied to my thing earlier about enjoying bringing people together. And so I enjoy doing that. So sharing that load with Lea Michele is not only a relief, but very exciting. So we share a lot of musical history, you know, obviously between Glee and Broadway, but she has her own solo records. I have my own solo records, and she's sung songs that I've written. So seemed like a natural fit. We had some free time and wanted to take it on the road, baby. It's very fun. I'm excited for folks that haven't had a chance to experience that, to get to experience that. Because we're going to places that I've been a lot of places, and I'm going to quite a few that I've never been to, which is a great thing.
Oh, good luck with that. And another happy news is that last January you announced your engagement to Mia Swire. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Swire, yeah, yeah.
Okay. You and Mia have been going out for almost 8 years. That's a record for a relationship in show business. What grounds that relationship and what makes it work?
Well, we've been together for a long time, and I think like a lot of great relationships, we were friends first, and we've been through everything together, and that only fortifies a relationship more. You know, it's not without its ups and downs for sure, but you know, such is life, such is love, and we've had sort of a wonderful partnership these past many years, and you know, it was about time.
And in these times calling for diversity in Hollywood and everywhere, where do you stand as a mixed race actor on this issue?
I'm such a bleeding heart idealist that, and I'm sure there's people that have had it much, much worse than me that would maybe put me in my place. But I truly believe that I think everybody really does have the best intentions. I think there are more people trying to diversify and do not only the right thing, but the more interesting thing. There are more of those people than not. I think every now and then we have these sort of spurts of examples of things where whitewashing can kind of happen. Even then, I don't think it's intentional. I truly do believe that the people that are in charge of those decisions are not making them at the proactive detriment of diversifying Hollywood. I think there's just maybe some misguided decisions that don't understand what they're doing. And I think with every sort of outcry that happens, I think people in charge are learning more and more and understanding what representation and identity means to a lot of people. And I think all those people in charge do take these things into consideration, or at least I have to believe that. And I hope that I'm right, and maybe I'm completely wrong, but I do, you know, meeting a lot of these, you know, casting directors and people that want to create colorful storytelling, literally and figuratively, I think they really do their best. And at the end of the day, they're trying to figure out what can tell the story the best. And at the end of the day, it comes down to good storytelling, regardless of race or ethnicity and or sexuality. And, you know, there's really cool examples of us bending these norms. I think, you know, examples what Ava did with Wrinkle in Time was really cool. And I'm a theater kid, so I'm used to seeing, you know, gender and race and age being bent all the time. It's a convention. It's the best convention for it's the best platform to bend convention in the theater. And I think some more of that is happening in film and television. But I guess what I'm saying is I believe that things are going in a better direction. And I think that there's a victory in the discussion that's being had. I'm not in a position to suddenly make everything, you know, how we would like it, because everyone might want something a different way. But I'm proud to be mixed race, and I think it's cool to be representing that in some small way in the media. But you know, we have a long way to go, and I think that starts with, you know, us not representing the actors necessarily, but the storytellers. And there are so many great narratives from all walks of life that have yet to be told, and that's where I think it needs to start more, is focusing more on people with voices that are unique to a particular nationality or ethnicity or what have you, and then from there making sure we cast accordingly. But I think a good actor is a good actor, or a good writer is a good writer, and a good musician is a good musician, and hopefully there's no color to that. There's just quality, and I think that should supersede color.
You mentioned let's go back to the piano bar. That sounds like a fun thing to do, so tell us about it.
Well, this is something that I used to say it was a pipe dream, but now we're doing it, so I guess we've done it. It was always a dream that Mia had. I have little to nothing to do with the bar. I'm literally just the pianist, and people say, "Oh, that can't be. You're the actor. You must have had a strong hand." I mean, I to be crass and talk about money for a second, you know, I put so much of what I make back into the, my personal projects. So, you know, I was like clamoring, like, oh my God, how am I going to help with this bar? So it's mostly Mia because I'm running around spinning all these other plates. This was something that, you know, she comes from a venue family. Her father and uncle were part of Bowery Presents or were part of it. And, you know, she grew up in bars and venues. And so this was something she always wanted to do. She always wanted to call it Tramp Stamp Grannies. I have a personal history with piano bars. We share a personal history, me and I, of loving many piano bars in New York and in San Francisco. And it's just something we always wanted to bring to Los Angeles. At least the kind of piano bar that we're interested in. And, the old adage of, you know, if you build it, they will come has been really true. It's been a delight in the past month to see the kind of folks that show up and tell us how much they've really been longing for a place like Tramp Stamp Grannies. But to get to details, it's a piano bar in the sense that there, instead of a DJ, there's a pianist. So if you want to hear a song, pianist will play it, and they're just playing a really great mixture of tunes. We lean towards show tunes, but of course there's a lot of pop contemporary standards that are played all night. And people gather around. It's like our living room at home. I mean, for the longest time, the end of every party would end up at our house, and it'd be me on the piano or guitar leading a sing-along. And, you know, however many dollars worth of alcohol later and broken glasses, me and I said, you know, we should probably start charging for this. So that was the reason we really finally went to first gear with opening this bar. And she's done a really magnificent job, and I wish I could take more credit. But again, I'm just the pianist. It was her vision. And it really does look and feel really beautiful and like the dream that she always had. So we're so proud to share it with people.
And the name of the place? Tell us.
The name of the place is Tramp Stamp Grannies.
And where?
It's in Hollywood, right on Cahuenga and North Cahuenga in Hollywood. I think they call it the Cahuenga Corridor. I think that's the proper thing. But all I can just do is I feel like I've exhausted my credit to Mia, but that's, I mean, I really can't praise her enough. Her and our business partner is this guy, Danny Massari, who's sort of the business end and me is the creative. And again, I just hit the keys.
So what's next for you? What are your goals? How do you see yourself 10 years from now?
Well, I keep joking with people because I've had such wonderful reaction to Versace, not only for the performance, but just for the project itself. I'm just so thrilled people watched it. You know, there are a lot of things I've done that I'm very proud of, but I don't expect people to have seen it, at least at the level that they've seen, you know, this show. And not even seen it, but wanting to talk about it. It's not like you're competing with yourself, because that's a really unhealthy way of thinking about your work. But I certainly would be hard pressed to try and match how many wonderful boxes were ticked on this show, that hopefully I can just tick boxes that I didn't even know existed. But the goal, I guess, would be to continue what I was saying before, which is continuing to break out into other things and to keep myself and other people off balance. I am a devout fan of the human race, despite all our flaws, warts and all. I love all the different colors we have in our palette and all the wonderful and terrible things that we're capable of. And to be able to represent and bring to life all those things to me is the goal. I mean, to me, I'm in it for the long game. You know, I'm all about not these quick hits and quick fixes. Everything is connected to each other. So it all has to be a departure from the last thing. And where does that stand in the canvas of all the other colors we've painted thus far? That's the way I look at everything. But my joke I've been saying is because it's so hard to meet something like this. Because thus far, I wouldn't say this is the role of a lifetime, because hopefully, you know, there's many more things to come in my lifetime. But as of yet, this certainly has been the project of a lifetime. So much so that I joke in 10 years, I'll be the maybe forgettable villain in Batman 12. And then everyone's going to go, oh, God, you know, it's really too bad what happened to that guy. And I'll be like, but guys, remember Versace? That was good, right? You liked that. And they're going to be like, Darren, that was 10 years ago. Get over it. Quit living in the past. So I don't know. Hopefully keep breaking out in new ways in different areas. I fancy myself, or my goal is a character person. I enjoy character acting. If I can keep diversifying that portfolio, that would be a total goal. Yeah.
But speaking of roles of a lifetime, maybe there's a role or two that you are dreaming of to portray someday?
I don't think my imagination is good enough to think of a role. I think some of the best stuff that comes out, we can't conceive. We don't know. It really takes the mind of a true visionary. Somebody like Ryan to come along and like I said, actors are only as good at the moments they get. Other than that, we're just tools in a toolbox, just hoping someone will pick us up and use us to our full capacity. And Ryan was, and it takes somebody like Ryan to really, you know, if someone just sees me as a particular screw or a nail, you know, Ryan is the kind of guy that says this guy is a wrench, a hammer, a soldering iron, and a power drill. Like he knows, he can see all the different things in me. And to that, I'm really forever grateful. So, I think it would take someone else like that can kind of see more than maybe even myself or see what I see. You know, every project is a negotiation between what I know I can do and what I see myself doing or who I see myself as and what people are willing to see you as well. So finding that middle ground is a tango between you and someone that has the keys to that dance floor, you know, someone that can really facilitate that. There are certainly projects I'd love to do on my own as a creative. I'm a puzzle lover. I like putting pieces together. I like trying to figure things out. And in that sense, I enjoy getting scripts from people and seeing how I'd make it work. But on the creative front, there's a few. You know, I miss writing musicals. I miss writing scores and a full set of songs for a narrative. So I definitely have a few things in the back burner that are kind of on the 5-year plan that I'd like to do. And I'm much more in the front seat on those lines. But I don't know if I would play those parts. I would just give those off to much more talented people than myself. But who knows? If there are roles that exist that I'd love to play, I couldn't deign to say I want to play them because they've probably already been played by somebody great. And if there's a person out there that I'd love to play, I wouldn't deign to say I'd play them because they already did a good job of being themselves in real life. So I have... I look forward to being surprised by something and interested in something that I don't even see coming, because that means nobody else has seen it coming, which would be a goal for me.
For my last question, let's go back to Harry Potter. By coincidence, and what a coincidence, you replaced Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah.
In How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. So did you get to talk to him about your musical comedies, your parodies of Harry Potter?
I'm sure he's vaguely familiar with it. When we met, I didn't bring it up because I thought I think it's the pink elephant in the room. But this was years ago when I met him right before I did the show. He's always been very friendly. We see each other around town every now and then. And, you know, there's more interesting things to talk about than Harry Potter. When we're together for the brief moments we are together. And so we'll probably gab about those things. But I'm sure it is not lost on him, and it was never lost on me, just the funny sort of serendipity of all that. But I as a fanboy of a lot of stuff, one of the many thrills of my career, and I guess one of the top goals that I'm aiming for is I've been inspired and brought here by so many different people, stories, things, properties, that getting to meet these people is almost like it's the full circle moment where they got you sort of indirectly to where you are. So getting to thank them and see them in person or work with them even is the ultimate validation of that work and that inspiration. You know, getting to be around people like Penelope Cruz or Ricky Martin, people that I've always been a fan of and have inspired me. They've been a part of my narrative for a long time, unbeknownst to them. And now that I'm a part of theirs, is the ultimate fulfillment of gratitude, and the circle of inspiration gets complete, and then we start a new circle, which is really one of the great joys of my life. So when, you know, getting to meet Daniel and be now a part of his narrative in a way that he was a part of mine is a really, really fulfilling moment for me. And if I can keep chasing those professionally, there's really nothing better.
Well, it was certainly a pleasure talking to you, Darren. Likewise. And thank you again on behalf of the Hollywood Foreign Press.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and say I think this might be the best interview I think I've ever done in my life.
Oh, thank you.
The HFPA in Conversation is executive produced by Kirpi Wimonen, produced by Lorenzo Soria and Matt Smith. This episode hosted by Ruben Nepales, editing by Matt Smith, music by Cameron Chambers for the HFPA, logo by Jason Little for the HFPA. Be sure to rate and review us on iTunes and Apple Podcasts. Follow us on social media at Golden Globes. The HFPA in Conversation is a production of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which owns all rights in the recording.